Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Our speaker is Dimitar Bechev, fellow at the Center for Slavic, Eurasian, and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Bechev's lecture is titled Religious Identity and Foreign Policy, Russia and Turkey in Southeast Europe. Tonight's moderator is Pardee School Professor of the Practice of International Relations, Vesco Garcevich. We begin with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe Director, Kathy Martin.
Thank you so much for coming. So I particularly want to welcome Dmitry Bechev to Boston University, who's going to talk about religious identity and foreign policy. We're very excited about that. Vesco Garcevich is going to kick us off today and moderate. Vesco is also someone who knows a lot about this topic, so I think it'll be a very exciting exciting discussion. So without further ado, I think Vesco is going to introduce Dmitry.
This night we have Dmitry Bechev, who wrote the book Rival Power Russia in Southeast Europe. Book was issued in 2017, very actual, comprehensive. I introduced it to my Balkans class, of course. So he's also currently a fellow at the Center for Slavic, Eurasian, and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And finally, he is the director of the European Policy Institute, a think tank based in Sofia. The fact that I put institute at the end doesn't mean that it's not as relevant as other things. So, Dmitry, floor is yours. And I'm looking forward, and I think all of us looking forward to your presentation this evening.
Well, thank you, Vesco, for this generous introduction. It's a great pleasure for me to be with you, and thank you for making your way here. I first owe you a slight apology. I'm a scholar of foreign policy mostly, so whatever I say about religion should be taken with a grain of salt. But since this is the theme of the series, I thought that I should share some observations. And why is that issue relevant? Well, if you open any newspaper article about Southeast Europe or a think tank paper, one heading that jumps out right away is that the age of empires is back, West is in decline, and guess who is filling the gap? It's the old imperial powers of Turkey and Russia. We're almost as if we are back to the 19th century or the early 20th century, when you had still the Ottomans and you had Russia asserting its influence thanks to its connection to peoples in the region who confess Eastern Orthodoxy. Now, the picture here, and I have a bunch of pictures just to illustrate what I have to say before I get into the whole nexus between religion and foreign policy. Now, this is from May this year, Erdogan coming to Bosnia, to Sarajevo. Now, the person, he was denied the opportunity to campaign amongst Turkish communities in Germany, but also in the Netherlands, and he chose Bosnia to be there as a kind of substitute to his foothold in Europe and rallying all people, mostly Bosniaks, who expressed sympathy for Turkey, but also support for the kind of politics he personifies. So this is the Turkish example. But it's not just Erdogan, much closer to today. This is the 17th of January, which happens to be my birthday as well. But Putin came to Belgrade on a high-profile visit. And one of the highlights of the visit was paying his respect to the Cathedral of St. Sava. So St. Sava is the patron saint of Serbia, going back to the 13th century. But more importantly, this is the moment it's completed, it will be one of the largest Orthodox cathedrals anywhere. It's a new Byzantine building, and it's being renovated and completed with a large grant by the Russian state. Indeed, what Putin did, and that's Putin, President Vucic, and also Patriarch Irineus of Serbia. But this is Putin here in the crypt, putting symbolically the last bits in a mosaic, representing Christ the Savior. And if you pay close attention at the color pattern, you see white, blue, and red. Incidentally, this is the colors of the Russian flag, but also of the Serbian flag. So you see the symbolism very much there. Now, this is also reflected in the kind of rhetoric you hear from both leaders, Erdogan and Putin. I have some examples here. The example from Erdogan goes back to the moment he won the local elections in 2014. And that's become a standard quote with his speeches. Whenever he would win election, he'll frame it as a victory not just for himself or for his constituents, but for a larger community spanning the borders of the Ottoman Empire. So he said, "I thank my brothers in the Balkans, in Bosnia, in Macedonia, in Kosovo, in all cities in Europe who celebrate our victory with the same joy we have here. And I thank my suffering brothers in Syria who pray for our victory." So he is the epitome of a community of religious believers who span from Bosnia all the way to the Middle East and North Africa. But it's often the same in the case of the Orthodox. And I have a quote not by Putin, but a quote by Alexander Vucic. So before Putin came to Belgrade, Vucic was in Moscow, and he shared an episode how Putin invited him to his home after hours. He played piano for him. But here's the highlight. Vucic presented him with an icon. And that was in violation of protocol, so the security people were not aware, but somehow Putin was welcoming, and he put it right away on his mantelpiece. And there was it, the brotherhood of those two. Other examples beyond electioneering and using religion in those occasions is the aid coming from Turkey, just like from Russia, for the restoration of religious sites. What we have here is Erdogan and his wife, Emine Erdogan, a very influential person, by the way, but that's a separate conversation, together with Bakir Izetbegovic, the Bosniak member of the tripartite presidency of Bosnia, reopening the so-called Imperial Mosque, Tsareva Jamia, in Sarajevo, again restored with money from Turkey. Those monuments tie back to the early days of the Ottoman conquest, very much done in the Ottoman style. And regrettably, I don't have another picture from Pristina where they're building a big mosque. Now, Pristina case is interesting, if you allow me a diversion, because there was a rival project by the famous architect Zaha Hadid, modernistic mosque, but the Pristina authorities ultimately settled for a design proposed by the Turks, which is, again, in this Ottoman tradition. So this is the Ottoman tradition building on the Byzantine tradition. You have a new Byzantine church. You see how this all meshes, connects together. So the question I want to address is, what do you make out of it, of this prevalence of religion, religious references in state-to-state relations? And there are two ways to think about it. One is to kind of dust off your old foreign affairs journals, issues of foreign affairs journal, and go back to Samuel Huntington, who across the river here actually wrote about civilizational rallying. So I quote, groups of states belonging to one civilization, of course civilization is defined by religion in his view, become involved in war with people from different civilizations, naturally try to rally support from other members of their own civilization. Now, you can forget war, but just generalize, and you can also bring in other international phenomena, cooperation, competition through various means, the violent. The point to me here is that religion is the main driver. It shapes state behavior. Of course, Russia and the Serbs will be on one page because they are part of a community which is defined by Orthodox belief, Christian Orthodox belief. And of course, Bosniaks Albanians in the region or others who will be feeling the same about Turkey because they are bound by this common legacy. Another Orthodox connection here is that it's not just the Western Balkans. This is an image from St. Panteleimon Monastery in Mount Athos, when in 2016 Putin was given imperial treatment. That was a seat reserved to the Byzantine emperor there, and there was he in 2016 with next to him the former minister of foreign affairs, Nikos Koutsias, a common friend of ours with Dimitri, who's not anymore in the foreign ministry. So that's one, but also I have a picture of Putin kissing an icon given to him by the late Bulgarian patriarch Maxim, and that's his successor, the current patriarch here. So that's one perspective. What is the alternative perspective? Well, the alternative perspective, and I must say, put my cards on the table right away, is the instrumentalization of religion. The use of religious symbols, references, the cultural repertoire, if you will, in advancing state-to-state diplomacy. And one entry point into this kind of debate actually goes back to one of the responses to Huntington by a gentleman called Fuat Ajami, the late Fuat Ajami. He was a renowned scholar of the Middle East, but he was very articulate when he tried to respond to Huntington. And he actually he said that ultimately states use religion. So he said it better than I did. Nations cheat, they jiggle identities and interests. Their ways meander. One would think that the traffic of arms from North Korea to China, to Libya and Iran and Syria shows this. The states will consort with any civilization, however alien, as long as the price is right and the goods are ready. So it's a more cynical reading. But I think the main point here is that civilization is not a driver. It's part of the state toolbox. So how do I argue the case? Well, I want to, first of all, go beyond the Balkans and look specifically at Turkey and Russia. The kind of societies they have and the domestic arrangement they have to do with state and religion, and then work my way to foreign policy more generally and finish with a few observations about the Balkans. Now, first question we should be asking is, how important is religion in the daily life of societies? I think in Turkey, it's much more central than in Russia, and it's supported by data. Now, last couple of weeks, there was an interesting survey by one of the pollsters in Turkey, Konda, which counterintuitively argued that, the majority of Turks obviously identify with Islam. But if you look at the level of observancy, how many of them abide by the principles of Islam, they registered a decline from 60 to about 51% of Turks. But it's a substantive percentage. That's a very high percentage. And it's very high, not just in comparison to Western Europe, but also with Russia. So in Russia, 57%, according to the Pew Research Center, think that religion is very important. But if you ask the question, how often do you go to services, at least once a monthly? Do you go to services at least once a monthly? The percentage goes down to 17. And that's despite the recent trend since Putin came to power for a third term, stressing conservative values in opposition to the West and stressing religion and making a lot of statements, encouraging giving religion a more prominent place in Russian society. If you operationalize conservatism as attitudes to social practices, same-sex marriage, then you have a different picture in Russia. But if you look specifically at practices of religion in everyday life, then you see a convergence between Russia and Western society, which is very often missed. Now, let's look at beyond society to politics and domestic institutions. Now, first of all, Russia is not an Orthodox society. There's more to Russia. It's one of the big Muslim countries in Europe. It's very hard to ascertain the number of Muslims in Russia. But it's probably in the region of 15 million. So that will make about 10% or more of the population. Here we're talking about people who hold citizenship of the Russian Federation in places like Tatarstan, but also in the North Caucasus, as well as migrants from Central Asia, whether documented or undocumented. So it's a big demographic in Russia. By contrast, Turkey is, as a result of its modern history in the late Ottoman and the early Republican era, is almost entirely a monocultural society. It doesn't mean that cultural cleavages or ethnic cleavages don't exist, but non-Muslim communities have been decimated and reduced to a very small number, and they play a very important symbolic role, but in terms of numbers, they are not very prominent. The similarity is the following. Because of institutional history, faith and state in both places are merged. In different ways, of course. But in Russia, you could argue that the Russian Orthodox Church has a privileged position, but it does have an independent role. It says be subservient to the state. Somebody by the name of Evgeny Minchenko recently wrote a report trying to map out power in Russia. And he called Putin in his inner circle the new Politburo. I mean, you can stretch this analogy and problematize it because Russia is not the Soviet Union. What is interesting from our point of view is that he put Patriarch Cyril in the second tier, in other words, the candidate members for the Politburo, not the inner circle. But the message is that church is a department of state. And of course, in Russia, in Turkey, that's been the case institutionally because the Department of Religious Affairs is a state agency. Imams are paid state salaries. And every Friday, the prayer, the sermon they receive, is vetted by the DNS, the Department of Religious Affairs. To that point that even people who confess other forms of Islam, the Alevi community first and foremost, have this persistent grievance against the state because their own clergy is not recognized and they don't get the same benefits from the state. They don't have pensions, salaries, their sites of religious worship of the Alevis are not exempt from taxes and so on and so forth. But again, you know, you can probably make this parallel that church and state or faith and state in both places is merged together. There is no separation, which also means that the state is much more likely to exercise control and instrumentalize religion when need be. The difference, of course, and again, looking at domestic politics, is that in Turkey, Islam plays in public life. You have a party in power, which has been influenced by Islam. It promotes Islamic values in public life. And people who represent the party, who they might be cynical politicians, Erdogan starting first and foremost, but it's not that they don't have a pious lifestyle. So, and also Islam is an important ideological bond between the party constituents and the party itself. So it plays a more central role than in Russia. Now, let's look now at foreign policy, and I want to look at foreign policy discourse and foreign policy practice. At the level of discourse, Of course, religion has become much more central than in the past. With Russia, that happened with Putin coming to power in 2012, partly as a result of the standoff between Russia and the West. Indeed, you could argue there is a connection to domestic politics, because before, in the 2000s, Russia and Kremlin could legitimize itself by pointing at the years of prosperity and economic growth. In the new term, after the economic crisis and with Putin shifting in a conservative position, this idea of Russia as a champion of conservative values became much more of a leading team. But that's not the whole story, and it goes back to this Ajami point about juggling identities. If you look at Russian foreign policy over a longer period of time, you could see how Russia also used its Islamic face to influence international relations. First of all, Russia joined the Organization for Islamic Cooperation as early as 2005. Because there was benefit of opening to this part of the world. Putin, by the way, was the first leader who traveled to Saudi Arabia. And now more recently we saw the king coming to Russia. In 2009, Medvedev actually argued that Russia does not need to seek friendship with the Muslim world. Our country is an organic part of this world. I mean, that's an argument you are not very likely to hear from a Turkish policymaker. The foreign policy discourse is structured elsewhere. The closest I can think of was when Davutoğlu was the foreign minister, when at some point he said that the Armenians in the diaspora are also part of the Turkish nation. But that was a very bold statement, and it's very unlikely somebody will say it right now. But Russia has been juggling. And it's not just discourse. Sometimes it has practical implications. When the Russians took over East Aleppo, whom did they dispatch first there in an operation to win hearts and minds? Well, military police from Ingushetia and from Chechnya. So they made a point by sending Russian Federation citizens of Muslim, or you can call them culturally Muslim, because we shouldn't assume about their level of observancy. But broadly, people of Muslim culture, Muslim background, to make a point to the local Syrians that Russia is not necessarily an alien, but it has this connection, this identity, which shouldn't be forgotten. What has happened in Turkey? You have more and more references to Islam as part of the foreign policy identity with the AKP era. Islam has become much more central. And you can compare that to earlier engagement of Turkey in its neighborhood. Now, if you go back to the Bosnian War, there was a lot of demand for Turkey to intervene, and it did intervene on behalf of the Bosniaks. But the then leadership, and the person I have in mind, is the then foreign minister in 1993, Hikmet Çetin. He was very insistent that Turkey came into Bosnia, first of all, as a NATO member, so it was a multilateral approach rather than a partial player to one of the communities. And secondly, as a country defending a universalist ideal. So it was on behalf of human rights as opposed to on behalf of Islam. And it made sense because at the time Turkey was trying to argue its case that it was representing, you know, a country that has opened to integration into the European Union and into NATO. Any arguments to do with culture and identity would be firing back at the Turks. If you are a champion of Islam, then that would be feeding into anti-Turkish rhetoric. And this mode of thinking actually persisted in the 2000s, going back to the U.S. Administration under Bush. So under Bush, there was a moment in time when, after the invasion of Iraq, there was the notion of Turkey as a model for the Middle East. So the whole issue of Turkey as a model has an interesting pedigree. But ultimately, at the time, Turkey resisted. Turkish foreign policymakers and diplomats were against it. Why? Because it was pigeonholing Turkey as a Muslim country and it was undercutting its chances. And there was a pushback from Turkey itself. Well, fast forward to 2009. Turkey actually actively embraced under Davutoğlu and the later Erdogan era the notion of a model and embraced this idea that Islam was useful in foreign policy and it made sense to use this identity to stress links to countries in its vicinity. And it got really reinforced after the Arab Spring, put together regimes in many places like Egypt, who are ideologically close to the AKP. So you could see that at the level of rhetoric, Turkish foreign policy evolved from a more universalist position, arguing that Turkey is a special case and shouldn't be pigeonholed in the Muslim world, to actually embracing this part of Turkish identity. Now, my final point here is about the actual practice of foreign policy. Not just what politicians and diplomats are saying, but actually what they do. And then the question is, how much actually we can see religion influencing alignments and foreign policy decisions? And I'd say not that much. And the most obvious example actually goes back to Turkey and Russia themselves, the two of them. If you believe in the power of history and identity, you wouldn't be seeing that much of cooperation and convergence between the two. Obviously, there's a lot more at stake, a lot more going on there. People who have this essentialist reading of foreign policy and society in both countries would assume that they fought in the past, and of course they'll be doing so in present. And they were vindicated for a time in 2015, 2016, when because of Syria, Putin and Erdogan were fighting one another. And the standard interpretation was, look, those people, the Tsar and the Sultan, Ottomans and the Russians, they're back at each other's throat. Well, what happened was very different, actually. They found a way to embrace one another, to engineer rapprochement, and actually to cooperate. Secondly, Turkey didn't quite intervene very forcefully on behalf of its ethnic kin in Crimea, because other considerations to do with rational interests trumped their concern and their feeling of solidarity with their kinsmen. And that's not a story that starts yesterday. We did discuss the Second Chechen War in 1999 when, that was even before Erdogan, when Prime Minister Bülent Ecevit actually said it very openly and faced criticism at home that that's a war which is Russia's internal business and Turkey was not there to question anybody else's territorial integrity because guess what, we have the same problem with the Kurds. So strategic interests as defined, and also economic interests, and we can go back discussing it in the Q&A, have put those close together. Another point would be that if you look not at the bilateral relationship, but actually what they do in the Balkans, you see, for instance, that Turkey has been very flexible and trying to find a common cause with nations and countries where you don't have actually Muslim minorities. The assumption is that, look, Turkey wants to be in Bosnia and Kosovo and elsewhere because there is immediate connection. But in actual fact, if you do the numbers and look at the trade flows, then you see that the main trading partner of Turkey is Romania, and number two and number three are, depending on the year, Greece and Bulgaria. Why is that? Well, just the size of the market and the fact that they're in the EU, and Turkey is having a customs union with the EU. That matters. So despite activism, despite involvement, you have that. More than that, my last picture here illustrates Turkey's rapprochement with Serbia. Now, you should think that Turkey has the memories of the Yugoslav wars, the genocide in Bosnia. I mean, Serbia is run by somebody who was the Minister of Information under Milosevic at the tender age of 27. Well, guess what? They found their common denominator with Erdogan. Now, Erdogan visited. And Serbia did what Russia did, played its Muslim side. They invited Erdogan to a Muslim-majority region in Novi Pazar. The locals put a picture of Erdogan. They were flying Turkish flags, but they were flying Serbian flags as well. And you could see how culture was used as a bridge, but essentially it was a government-to-government business to do with economic relations, also political relations. So the leaderships in both countries have been very flexible in terms of finding a path to one another, so much so that when you go to places like Sarajevo, you see the same discourse time and again. The Turks come to Bosnia, they fund the restoration of mosques, but then they go to Serbia and they invest into the economy and they're building pipelines and roads. So there's this very ambiguous response to Turkish actions on the part of many many Balkan Muslims. Now, a final word here about religion as a bridge. I don't want to go all the way back and all the way to the extreme and say that religion doesn't matter. In fact, it does, because it creates this glue and it creates this resource for politicians to build upon. And it creates some sort of social connectivity as well. So I'd say that the connectivity is much more important for the Turkish case than for the Russian case. Not just because Turkey is more pious, at least in my interpretation, than Russia, but also the nature of its relationship with the Balkans, Southeast Europe. Now, up to 20% of Turks have roots in the region. We are talking about different generations of the 200 years migrating from various places in the Balkans. But those guys in Novi Pazar, they have been to Turkey, they have their cousins there, they have family. And they are accepted by the Turkish society as kin because of religion being the defining principle of national identity in Turkey, at least one of the pillars of national identity. Russia, by contrast, doesn't have this direct connection to the Balkans. I mean, there were Balkan migrations, but for example, in Bessarabia, which is now in Moldova and Ukraine, but not that much in Europe. It's not that Russia was built by people coming from the Balkans, as was the case in the early Republican era, Turkey, including the founder of the Republic. So at this level, you see how religion cannot be dismissed, not as actual practice of Islam, but as a social bond. And the other thing to say about religion is that, of course, Russia has this bridge as well, but it's mediated. The way it works institutionally is that you have the Russian Orthodox Church, and then you have a bunch of national churches. So it's often through church to church, which also means state to state, because those churches are fused or codependent with secular authorities in the Balkans. So it's again top down. It's not the kind of bottom up social dynamic that the Orthodox will be instinctively embracing Russia. So ultimately, I think, in the Turkish case, if you go back to the two competing claims, you see more of this kind of civilizational unity with all caveats and qualifications. I think in the Russian case, it's much more pragmatic, and the instrumental use of religion is much more central to Russian foreign policy. And we can discuss later on what it means and maybe go back to the whole Ukrainian autocephaly issue. I'm sure you have burning questions about it.
Okay, thank you, Dimitri. Thank you for your informative, very interesting presentation about religion and religions, and Turkey and Russia, how they use them or how they utilize them for their own political interests. I will be, for the sake of our conversation, let me play a role of a hardliner, which one who believes and who thinks that religion is used, particularly when I say here religion, I would like to make a clear distinction between religion and church, because it is church which matters, and the church is utilized as an effective tool, cost effective, to reach out to people and to influence their minds. Long time ago, Machiavelli said that if other things don't work, then it's useful to turn to religion. So, I would say here, in both cases, other things work, at least in our part of the world, but religion makes them work better. Yeah. So, just an anecdote. I'm sure that you know for this case, when the Russian Patriarch paid official visit to Bulgaria and talking to Bulgarian president. He gave him a lesson how to behave and how to treat Russia. So that the behavior of a patriarch during that official visit with the president of Bulgaria was far from being diplomatic. If I were there, president of Bulgaria, in accordance with diplomatic rules, if someone tells you something like that in front of media, you should stand up and leave the house, because he is not one to give you lessons about history, politics, and so on and so forth. It is also perception, what you can do, what you can do, and what you cannot do. So this brings me to how Russia utilizes church for its own purposes. You mentioned a commission that exists in Turkey. There is also a religious commission in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia, made up of representatives of Russian Orthodox Church and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But you also mentioned, and I agree with you, that the majority of people, Orthodox people, they identify as Orthodox, but actually identifying as Orthodox in their case is a national identity. They identify Serbs because they are Orthodox Serbian and they're Bulgarian and so on and so forth. In Yugoslavia, one of things that led to breakup of Yugoslavia was understanding that if you go to Orthodox Church, Serbian Orthodox Church, you can't be anyone else but Serbian, because there is no chance that you can say for yourself that you are Croat, Orthodox, so on and so forth. So then, therefore, you know, instrumentalization of this religion in order to promote to what is actually in my focus, how Russia instrumentalize this in order to promote some type of Eastern religious conservatism. So promoting values by church, that values of Eastern Christianity or Eastern conservatism have nothing to do with liberal democracy, have nothing to do with the parliamentary system, have nothing to do with accountability of those who are in power, and so on and so forth. Therefore, trying to find a link with people who challenge a liberal democracy from within in Western Europe. I see this as an effective tool how Russia tries to instrumentalize religion and creating a narrative that will help them reach out to different populist movements in Europe. Can you comment on it? Can you see this as like a well-grounded strategy, or you see this as just like a reaction to what's going on in Europe, a spontaneous reaction from Russia's side to what's going on in Europe?
Well, first a comment about this case you mentioned about the Russian Patriarch. It was not in front of the media.
Yeah.
It was secretly taped and then uploaded on YouTube. So the Russian Patriarch Cyril was meeting the president of Bulgaria, and Patriarch told off the Bulgarian president for NATO, a number of issues. So he lectured him, which was probably all right behind the scenes, and they could have parted friendly. But it turned out later on that somebody from the Russian delegation recorded, and then that was put on, I think, the YouTube channel of the Russian Orthodox Church. So that's one for modernism. And that was the diplomatic. I'm sure Bulgarian dignitaries are used to the Russians, you know, playing hardball with them on occasions. But that was the scandal. Mm-hmm. He used the active measure, you might call it, too. Whether that was purposefully done or somebody just tried to be more Catholic than the Pope or whatever you call it in the context of the Russian Orthodox Church, we don't know. But that was the blowback effect. Of course, Russia uses all kinds of levers, and that's an easy one, because you can appeal to people visceral thinking. You can make a statement, or you can pay a few million and restoring a church, and you have a greater soft power effect than anything else. One interesting question for me, and something that I come back to in my book, is not why Russia uses that or how effective it is, but why is it people or institutions or political actors respond the way they do to Russian overtures? Why there is low-hanging fruits? I mean, very often, going away from the example of religion, the internal conditions are very amenable to Russian interference. You have a Russian energy project, you can bribe your way into a particular country because there is demand. So the demand side is there. You have the Russian Orthodox Patriarch making a statement. Well, that resonates with locals. So we have to look at the other side. And further than that, the reason that there is this meeting of minds very often is to do with local dynamics that are not necessarily linked to Russia. I'll give you the example of Montenegro and Serbia. Now, of course, the Serbian Orthodox Church will be on the same page with the Russian Orthodox Church because they see a clear parallel. There is a dispute over Ukraine, the jurisdiction of Ukrainian parishes, and Montenegro has the same dispute with the Serbian Orthodox Church. There is a clear parallel. And now we assume that the Serbian Orthodox Church is with Russia. Well, it is most of the times, but not necessarily, because in 2016 there was the Ecumenical Council in Crete, in the island of Crete. It was convened by the Ecumenical Patriarch. The Russians boycotted it. That's again in the context of this rivalry between Constantinople and Moscow. And it's very interesting to see who turned up there in Greece and who didn't. Well, the Georgians and the Bulgarians didn't. So they took the Russian side. Well, the Serbians did show up. Which doesn't mean that I kind of question 100% how much there is a convergence on the ideological basis between the Serbian hierarchy, because it's also about values and principles. But there is politics at play as well. We shouldn't forget about that. And clearly the sovereignty jurisdiction dispute over Montenegro and the parallel we have with Russia-Ukraine, I think is quite important. And by the way, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but also Montenegrins have played on the Ukrainian analogy, saying that, and this we are talking about the secular side, not about the ecclesiastical side. When Montenegro was making its case for NATO, saying, you know, Serbia is Russia, we are Ukraine. So you missed a chance in Ukraine, but now, at least in this analogous situation, you can make up for that and accept Montenegro. And,
And then you know that recently Patriarch from Constantinople recognized also gave autocephality to Ukrainian church. Then Russia, in that case, Russia government, which Putin called Council for Security, Russian Security Council, to discuss that issue, which, in my view, is a typical canonical issue that is to be dealt between church. It has nothing to do with states. So he called immediately Russian Security Council and had a meeting in presence of Russian Patriarch, which for me is yet another example how church matters in Russian strategy to influence Eastern Europe, particularly Orthodox population. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's turn to and pick up questions. Introduce yourself, and then go on.
My name is Richard Rosen. I know very little about this area of the world, so forgive me if I make some blunder in the question. But you didn't mention economic issues at all, and I was wondering to what extent religion, through mediation by the state or not, plays any role in economic relations, paving the way for Russian business or Turkish business to spread through the region. Is there any role that religion plays in that function?
To some degree, but I don't think it's that important. I mean, the most direct example is, who is Russia's biggest economic partner in the area? It's Turkey, by virtue of its market, and Turkey has become the second largest customer after Germany of Russian natural gas. So religion might come into play because of various networks, but I don't think it's decisive. And you could easily turn it into a quantitative model and show it, but I think there are other issues at play with economic exchanges.
Hello, I'm Dimitri Sotiropoulos, University of Athens and Center for European Studies, Harvard University. We have learned a lot, as usual, from your talk. I was wondering if you could comparatively assess the different other tools and means which Turkey and Russia from time to time use to influence developments in southeastern Europe. I'm referring to diplomatic pressure, military assistance. For example, we have seen joint military exercises between Russia and Serbia. And in addition, we have seen an effort by Russia to use the Eurasian Economic Initiative to invite some countries of the region to join. And of course, as you also mentioned, a fourth tool or means would be the direct investment of Russian companies in various countries. So I understand your argument is that there is some instrumentalization of the churches and of religious institutions. But compared to all these other means, diplomatic, military, economic, how would you assess the influence of Russia?
Russia's two main areas of Russian leverage is one, the economy. Now, Russia is not a very important economic partner of the region, except on the import side, and mostly because of energy, oil and gas imports. But where it does have investments, they are concentrated in some areas like real estate, Montenegro, Bulgaria, even Greece, or in banking. And there is a lot of intransparency. And the way Russian entities do business in Russia, but also in the region, is not necessarily in line with rules of good governance and transparency. Now, you shouldn't assume that a Russian company, say Lukoil, is there to do Kremlin's bidding. They have an economic agenda. They want to make profits, whether legally or less so. But the point about those guys, by the way, Lukoil is headquartered in the Netherlands, so it counts as a Dutch investment. Sberbank is headquartered in Austria when they gave a loan to the Croatians to save the biggest public company. But the point is, if somebody in the Kremlin picks up the phone to Lukoil CEO and says, we have a political problem in country X, could you be of use? You cannot just turn down that because your main business is in Russia itself. So the boundary in Russia between state and non-state is very fuzzy. But also in the region itself. So I think that's one area of influence. And sometimes percentages might be misleading. You can say 70% of trade, 70% of investment is from the European Union. Well, Russia has some niches here and there, and they matter, because there's a lot of money which goes unaccounted. And it's not Russia's fault. It's also the fault of the deficits inside the region. It's not that Putin invented corruption in Bulgaria, to quote my own country of citizenship. It's not because of him. So there are openings. So that's one. The other one, which I think became much more important after 2014 with the standoff with the West and the annexation of Crimea, is the information warfare, kind of influencing the narrative. And again, you can explain it with not just supply, but also demand. You don't need to tell the Serbs, you don't have to preach to the Serbs much that NATO is a villain, because you just bring up the bombing campaign in 1999, and you can spin the narrative that Russia was a victim under Yeltsin, but also Serbia is a victim. So there is resonance. With relatively little investment, you go a long way peddling those narratives. They don't have to be pro-Russia in the sense that the knowledge of Russian society institutions is very limited. But anti-Western sentiments and feelings of inferiority or grudges, I mean, Greece would be another example, go a long way. Or also the same stories that get traction in the West, saying the threat of migrants from Syria or elsewhere in the Middle East, they play locally as well, because you evoke all of painful memories of imperial rule and what people learn in their textbooks about the Ottomans. So I think that's a clear area that Russia has an advantage, just by playing on this anti-Western sentiment, which is there. And it's prevalent in many countries. In Greece, in Turkey, anti-Americanism doesn't start yesterday. Even in Romania, which is a pro-Western country, you can find, if you start talking about LGBT rights, You don't have to say anything nice about Russia because Romanians won't buy it. But if you say something bad about the West and the kind of liberal agenda forced upon you, then you get quite a bit of resonance. So I think that's the other area of... It doesn't take much, and there is a lot of takers in the region for that.
And where you stopped, it is the point where the church jumps in.
Exactly.
When they have a problem with LGBT rights, when they have a problem with liberal ideas of liberalism, the church exploits that, those issues, developing its own narrative. But coming back to your question, just to echo what you mentioned, I don't know whether you remember, definitely this name is very well known here in the U.S. Deripaska once said for himself that he is nothing else but guardian of the state coffer, which means that he has his own company, but money and control is somewhere else. So, and then working and doing business with Russia is detrimental for institutions of those states, speaking about Southeast Europe, because it erodes already weak institutions in those states.
Okay, well, I just want to say thank you so much. Dimitar, that was a wonderful presentation. Vesco, thank you so much for commenting.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Dimitar Bechev, fellow at the Center for Slavic, Eurasian, and East European Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Bechev's lecture was titled Religious Identity and Foreign Policy, Russia and Turkey in Southeast Europe, and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Pardee School Professor of the Practice of International Relations, Vesco Garcevich. We began with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe Director Kathy Martin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Max Liebman. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.